I'm your host, Donna Loring. Joining me today are my regular guests, Dr. Harold Prince, anthropologist, historian, Dr. Darren Ranko, Penobscot Nation citizen, and we have a special guest, Ezekiel Crofton McDonald, ambassador for the Houlton Band of Maliseet Indians. As this country prepares to celebrate its 250th anniversary, Wabanaki people find ourselves asking the question, what does 250 years of American independence mean to the original people of this land? For many Americans, 1776 marks the birth of a nation. But for the Wabanaki nations, our history did not begin in 1776. We were already here. We had governments, diplomatic relationships, trade networks, customs, culture, and responsibilities to our homelands long before the United States existed. Today, we're going to explore 250 years of American history through Wabanaki eyes, from our relationships with European powers before the Revolution, through treaties, statehood, land laws, federal policy, and into the modern sovereignty movement. So, let's begin. Before 1776, what were the historic conditions for the Wabanaki, Harold?
Thank you, Donna, and welcome Zeke to the show. And of course, Darren, as my long-term conversation partner in these discussions about indigenous sovereignty, in particular with the Wabanaki nations in the Atlantic Northeast. 1775 is, of course, when the American Revolutionary War starts, but for, as Donna just said, for the Penobscot and the other Wabanaki nations, Maliseet, Mi'kmaq, and Passamaquoddy in particular, the history precedes as nations and sovereignty much longer than 1775. It goes back for untold generations that nobody can really remember how far that goes back. And since this is not about, quote, prehistory, but history, we will focus on 1775. And one of the important things to understand the motives for the Wabanaki nations, and I'm speaking here specifically of the Penobscot, Passamaquoddy, Maliseet, and Mi'kmaq, is the fact that they had lost their French allies by 1760. And so you have to go back to 15 years before, but in fact, you have to go back to 20 years before, because in 1755, there was a massacre of Penobscot at Owl's Head of a group of 12 Penobscots who were murdered, there's no other word for it, and scalped. The militia captain from Newcastle, Maine, was then Captain James Cargill. And by 1775, he had become a member of the Massachusetts Provincial Congress and had been promoted to colonel. And so in the minds of the Penobscot in particular, who were neighbors in Penobscot Bay to Muscungus Bay, where Colonel Cargill was the chief militia commander and a representative to the Massachusetts Provincial Congress, he was the mass murderer that Chief Orono knew was suddenly in power with the revolutionary government. So for an old man like Joseph Orono in 1775, he knew that he, in the chessboard of American history as it was unfolding, was suddenly confronted with a horrible choice, namely, warfare was impossible because of the French military support was gone after 1760. They were defeated and had given up Canada. The British were their historic enemies, but even more so, the American settlers with their militias who had repeatedly waged warfare. And in particular, following the massacre of 1755 at Owl's Head, which is where the portage route between Penobscot Bay and the St. George River historically was located. That's an extraordinarily important portage route because that's where the Penobscot would trade at where now is Thomaston. So Thomaston is the site of old Fort St. George. But that's historically also important. And now it reaches really back to 1605, because that's the area where the five Wabanaki were kidnapped by Captain George Weymouth in 1605. So that whole area around between Muskingus Bay and Penobscot Bay was fraught. And for the Penobscot in 1775, the line that had been agreed upon, namely at the head of the tide, just below the first falls, that was the recognized dividing line that the British government had recognized and that the American settlers were already intruding upon and beginning to settle above the falls. So when the war broke out in the spring of 1775, the great concern was that once the British had dismantled, basically forced to dismantle Fort Pownall at the mouth of the Penobscot River, that the Penobscot nations, but also their neighbors farther to the east, down east, were very upset because that infringed on their trading. And so the unrest that was reported from Falmouth, now called Portland, back to Watertown in 1775, that was a great concern. What would the Wabanaki nations do? Would they side with the British against the colonists, yes or no? And to make sure that the Penobscot and their allies in the Wabanaki Confederacy would minimally stay neutral, because that was the key element, and not side with the British, which was their fear, there was a mission sent under Captain John Lane from Watertown by way of Falmouth, now called Portland, to Fort Pownall that had been dismantled in part. And he then went up to the river to the head of the falls, where now is Mount Hope Cemetery, where there was a trading post. And from there, a mission was sent up to Indian Island to seek representation of the Penobscot. And so that's a long story to kind of set the scene for Joseph Orono and his three fellow Penobscots, then joining Captain John Lane by way of Fort Pownall back to Falmouth. And there, because the British occupied Boston by carriage, horse carriage, they were taken to Watertown, where they then had the meeting very soon after the disaster of the Bunker Hill battle that was lost at that time by the Revolutionary Army and was won by the British, but it was a short-term victory.
So, Darren, do you have some input for that time period?
Just a little bit. I mean, obviously, as always, Harold is quite thorough. I appreciate that, Harold. I think the other anti-British sentiment at Penobscot at the time, was connected to that Owl's Head massacre, where the Phipps Proclamation had actually come from the crown, the colonial authority, in issuing the scalps for Penobscots in 1755, which we've talked about quite a bit on this program. But that had to do with trying to force the Penobscot tribe at the time, to send help to the British who were fighting, or trying to resist the sort of Abenaki raids in the Connecticut River Valley, up and across sort of west of our homeland. And we refused to do that, and that led to the Phipps Proclamation for our scalps. So I think there's lots of push-pull, as Harold pointed out, like in terms of even us figuring out what we wanted to do, and sort of what that positioning is. And I think Chief Orono, of course, Harold references this 1775 trip, where I think he thought, I guess he was convinced enough by the plea that the Americans, I don't know what they call themselves, the Patriots, that they were assembling, the people who were forming a revolution against the crown, led him to say in 1775, this famous quote, "Our white brothers, the Americans, tell us that they came to our land to enjoy liberty and life, but their king of England is coming to bind them in chains and to kill them. We must fight them. We will stand on the same ground with our brother, the Americans." So he his declaration, that's a year before the Watertown Treaty, but his declaration was obviously saying, like, well, they're promising us a bunch of stuff, you know, and the run with the colonial British entities had not been super great in the last 20, 30 years, as Harold mentioned, and that, you know, that those incursions into Penobscot territory, especially on, you know, up into the west side of the Penobscot, and then even some incursions over to the east of the Penobscot. You know, these were being happening in the 1740s and 1750s. So I think it was very much a strategic choice by Orono, which reflects, I think, our diplomacies in that way. But you know, really, he had enough reasons to hate a bunch of different people, I guess, what I would say, and not trust them. But I think he made a very strategic choice, and it was definitely the folks in Washington, George Washington's sort of leadership that were making very hard plays to get Wabanaki, for all the reasons Harold mentioned, and we probably don't even have time to go into all the various letters and so forth coming from sort of the George Washington's leadership to kind of convince the Penobscot, Passamaquoddy, Maliseet, and others that you should stick with us. We're the real people that will help you out in this next phase of things. And that's all I have to add. I think just that diplomacy was leading up to a very clear consideration, as since Orono was already kind of going in that direction, it made sense sort of what happened next with Treaty of Watertown and a bunch of other things.
So, Harold, first of all, there must have been a really compelling reason for Orono to make this trip. He must have had something he was thinking about, you know, the reason, like, geez, I have to go to Watertown, and the reasons behind that, I think, had to do with preserving, you know, his people and his hunting lands. Did he actually come away with some sort of agreement, Harold?
Yeah, in 1773, Orono had already been to Boston and met there with Governor Thomas Hutchinson, who was a Tory, and there was an understanding that the line that I mentioned earlier that was recognized under the British Crown and in 1773 was reaffirmed, that there would be no intrusion above the head of the falls and above the head of the tide. So basically above where now Mount Hope Cemetery is, just north of Bangor, so where the Vesey Dam was until recently, roughly there. And so for Orono, the great concern was that if there was a revolutionary movement and the crown would be challenged in its sovereignty by the newly formed government in at that time not being able to convene in Boston but in Watertown, that recognition would be no longer reassured by the British Crown that earlier had been affirmed in the Royal Proclamation of 1763. So the Royal Proclamation of 1763, that in essence prohibited any private dealings of purchasing Indian territory without the permission of the British Crown, that suddenly was up in the air. So Orono, as a very sophisticated, highly experienced tribal leader who had come to the prominence in the course of the early 1770s, before that he was already a trusted leader, but that's really when he comes to the power position that he had as a chief diplomat. And that's really what was necessary in this incredibly complicated international scene that was for anyone, whether you were in Amsterdam, London, Paris, or in Boston or in Philadelphia, it was extremely difficult to oversee the strategic shifts that were happening in the course of 1775 and 1776, and then subsequent during the American Revolutionary War. And so Orono was by that time already a man, probably in his early 80s. We don't know for sure when he was born. But when he died in 1801, he was said to have been 113. A few years later, when his wife died, Madame Orono, he was said to have been 110. So take your pick. He would have been either born in 1688 or in 1691. but he was very old by the time of 1775. Just to put his age into perspective, his descendant, Charles Norman Shea, who passed away last fall, last winter, he was 101. And when he made his big trip back to Europe, he was 83, 84. And because I accompanied him on that trip, I can assure you that he was more fit than most people in about 20 years younger than he, 50, 30 years younger. He was a really remarkable. So I have Charles, his descendant, in mind when I'm looking at Orono in 1775 to make that arduous trip. That was not easy to make that trip, in particular because when he came back from Watertown and was taken back by carriage bound back to Falmouth, the schooner that was supposed to bring him back to Penobscot Bay and the river was not available. So he had to travel overland with his three companions by canoe. So by going canoe, probably through Muskingus Bay, but perhaps up to Kennebec and then the Sebasticook River, then up in making a portage into the Kanduskeg River, and he would have ended up there near the just below the trading post that I mentioned earlier, where now is Bangor, right? So just imagine this man of that age to making these journeys. And the moment he was back, he sent diplomats out, runners with wampum belts to the Passamaquoddy, then passed on to the Maliseet, as they were known as that time, and then on to the Mi'kmaq, all the way to Cape Breton. So it's an extraordinary quick spreading of the news. Anyway, there's much more to be said about it, but I will stop at this point.
I just have one more thing to add to before we push it to Zeke, is that part of the complexity in those times, basically from the 1740s onward up through the 1750s and 60s, was the just literally how much control the British, the seat of the colonial government in Boston had over the settlers, right? So that a lot of skirmishes were happening in a way that did not advance the interests of, say, the colonial authorities in Boston, but were advancing the interests of, like, families of settlers on the ground, and I think the piece that Harold led with Cargill, he was kind of pushing on that as a part of, like, pleasing his settlers who were demanding more access, more lands, more, and that often led to these quote unquote skirmishes or massacres, right, that are on the edge of the frontier, which were in violation of treaties, very clearly in violation of treaties, and in where the British had agreed to settle. But they, it's, I mean, we assume that, like, well, if this is the treaty and that the British have agreed to it, that somehow the settlers that are, hundreds of miles away, like, either know about it or agree with it, or are going to just, what are they going to do? Come up here and, force us out of it. And there's a famous, like, law case that in the 1740s that sort of recognizes the fact that, and that the crown brought against local settlers in on the favor of the Penobscots, right, that had this sort of decision that was defending Penobscot rights and the treaty. I mean, there's some crazy situations like that, but I think that's, I just want to bring that up into part of the complexity of, like, this diplomacy, like how Orono has to assess on the ground versus the authority from away how those are going to actually be implemented. And I think that has a lot to do with some of this work.
So, what I was trying to get at, Harold, when I asked you the question, was there an agreement? And maybe this didn't come from that time, about 6 miles on each side of the river being protected. Was that from that?
Yeah, that's an important comment that you make because that, of course, right after the Revolutionary War is over in 1784, that the General Knox, Henry Knox, who had vested interest in Wabanaki lands because they abutted the Penobscot reservation lands, or reserved the Penobscot tribal domains, he, together with a fellow general from the Revolutionary War, they were the two who went up to the Penobscot to basically compel them into signing a treaty, but the treaty was self-righteously, narrowly interpreted on the side of the colonists rather than on what Orono probably understood to have been agreed upon in 1775 when he pledged support against the British Crown for the American Revolution. In other words, the double dealing began right, actually not just after 70, in 17, after the Revolutionary War was over in 1783. So the treaty here opening was in 1784. That was not signed, by the way. It was not signed until 1796. So a lot of people make the confusion between the plans for the treaty and the actual signing. But the betrayal actually started the moment the Chief Orono was back, because the invasion continued, the double dealing continued, the theft of trade goods continued. So the whole thing was a total mess, as Darren was just indicating, by these frontier settlers, in particular, a guy like I mentioned earlier, Cargill, by that time colonel, and a official in the Massachusetts government. These guys were not people you would like to have as neighbors, but Orono and the Penobscot did not have any choice here. So, to your answer, the claim that it was a 6 mile stretch from the first of the falls was later quickly nibbled at, if you will. And of course, that claim was not stopped at above Old Town. It was claimed all the way to the sources of the Penobscot that the Massachusetts settlers did not really know the lay of the land there. So that 6 mile stretch on both sides of the Penobscot became embedded, but that's, I doubt very much that the Penobscot would have agreed to that circumscription. But nevertheless, for the settlers, of course, after 1784, it became extremely important to have access to, through that 6 mile boundary, because that's how you could get the logs out for the timber industry we've talked about before, right? So the timber was the major source of wealth, not so much the land, but it was the timber. Sorry, Darren.
Oh no, I was just gonna say, Donna, I have it for you, like what that
Yeah,
specific
I'd like to hear
piece
that. Could
is.
you tell me what
Yeah,
that is?
I can I'll tell you. So it's the same day Orono gives that speech. It's actually a resolution. So it's not even a law. It's a resolution that the provincial Congress there signed. And it says, strictly forbid any person or persons whatsoever from trespassing or making waste upon any of the lands and territories or possessions beginning at the head of the tide on Penobscot River, extending 6 miles on each side of said river, now claimed by our brethren, the Indians of the Penobscot tribe, as they would avoid the highest displeasure of this Congress. So it's clear, like, yes, was this an agreement, but it's not even in the form of a law or a treaty at that point. It's a resolution, but we must see those things together, right? Orono saying, we're, making that statement about they come to take you in chains, and then the provincial Congress, right, in the same place having this resolution. So it wasn't quite, I mean, that kind of, again, sets the stage perhaps for the Watertown Treaty, which has more specifics around this exchange.
Right. So we move forward now to 1796, I believe, the Watertown Treaty. And Zeke, do you want to tell us about that one? Because I don't think, believe Penobscot was part of that treaty.
Sure. Yeah. 1776.
Sorry, 1776.
I mean, first I'll say, Harold, Darren, thank you for all of that, because I was sitting here just learning. So my specific research in grad school was very focused in on the Woolstequay experience and the Maliseet experience. And I mean, part of that was a little bit on the Penobscot story. I mean, out of necessity, but a lot of what you guys just shared was new to me, which is it's fascinating, because I mean, it's out of necessity because, well, okay, so 1775, to bring it up to Woolastoqua territory, what was going on up there, along the St. John River, along the Woolastook, and a lot of my research also focused on Mi'kmaq territory as well. Most of our historic interactions were through the colony of Nova Scotia instead of Massachusetts Bay. So the limited interactions, from my understanding, when it came to the question of whether or not the Massachusetts Bay colonists would be good allies. From my understanding, took a lead to a certain extent from the Penobscot experience, and asked, so when it came to whether or not we wanted to ally with the Massachusetts Bay in 1775, 1776, turned to Penobscot to find out what their experience was like. But in 1775, one of the kind of threads that I pull at in my research that I think eventually led to us being interested in an agreement with Massachusetts Bay was and with the Second Continental Congress was trade. That was something I really focused on. So when the Watertown Treaty is eventually signed in 1776, in July of 1776, it was one of the biggest the main promise on behalf of the Second Continental Congress and on behalf of Massachusetts was that they would resupply the truck house at Machias, the trading post, which was a place where we would trade goods for primarily beaver pelts, but furs in general. And so there are multiple truck houses along the Wollastook that are owned, operated by the province of Nova Scotia, one of which was in Majorville. And Majorville was a point of immediate tension, anger. I mean, it's very similar to that Penobscot story, the Treaty of 1760 from signed between the Wolastoqing Nation, the Passamaquoddy Nation, and the British Crown, and through the rural governor in Halifax. So from our understanding, they agreed to stop expanding along the Wollastoq at a site called Grimross, and to not expand further upriver from there. What they did almost immediately, and travel up and survey the site that would eventually become Majorville, and is actually interesting, account, of a large company of Wolastoq warriors coming up and saying, no, this land is not, you can't be here. This was promised to us via treaty, but they came through anyway and built a settlement there, eventually built a trading post there. And in 1775, the Wolastoq Nation raided Majorville and destroyed a bunch of the material goods and took hostage the owner of the trading post, the truck house there, a man named John Anderson, who's mentioned in the Watertown Treaty, eventually, or the minutes of the Watertown Treaty. So part of what I kind of focused on in my thesis is, I think a big focus on trade and the trade abuses that were happening within these truck houses and the choice to instead travel all the way out to Machias to trade with the Massachusetts funded truck house out there, because the trust that was destroyed between the Wolastoq and the province of Nova Scotia, and the abuses that were happening at the hands of the crown, and the breaking of the Treaty of 1760, which among other things promised the exclusive right to hunt beaver, which also established a price table for furs traded out of truck houses, all of which was broken. In my opinion, one of the main ways this was broken was the Rural Proclamation of 1763. So in 1760, the rural governor in the Treaty of 1760 promised to basically only have a fixed price table for beaver furs, and the only way that they could really make sure that those fixed price table for furs was honored was by controlling trade. And in 1763, the king and privy council decided that that was a, I forget the phrasing, inappropriate monopoly, inappropriate control over trade, and open it up to any private traders, provided that they got a license to trade from the king. And And plenty of private traders kind of flooded into the area and started charging whatever they wanted for furs and breaking that price table for furs established in the Treaty of 1760. And from my understanding, that's part of the main reason why we traveled out to Machias to trade there instead with the colony of Massachusetts. And eventually, and this is another thing. The truck house, the truck master out there, a man named Stephen Smith in Machias, eventually sent a letter down to Massachusetts that said, when you guys appointed me truck master, I did not realize how many Wabanaki people would come through and try to trade. I completely overwhelmed almost immediately. It was Osway people, or it was Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, and Mi'kmaq people traveling down as well, all overwhelming the supplies in Machias. So they sent a letter down, courier by John Lang, Captain John Lang, and he brought it down to Watertown. And with that letter came, it was 10 ambassadors from the Wolstopway and the Mi'kmaq nations, and were down with alongside the letter. And if you want to read through the Watertown Treaty minutes, it begins, that first opening day begins with reading that letter. This is the main reason why they were there. It was to navigate the truck house crisis up in Machias. And but from there it actually switches goals in from my opinion, my research, because a new letter came from Washington to Massachusetts Provincial Congress, asking them to muster troops. And I actually find that fascinating. So the Wolstopway Mi'kmaq delegation was already there in Watertown when that letter arrived. And then, Massachusetts General Court there changes their objective. Suddenly they needed to provide troops to Washington. And so I think what those ambassadors eventually originally came down to navigate this truck house crisis, to ask for an increase in supplies in Machias. And they were suddenly in this position where Massachusetts, the Second Continental Congress, were asking them to go to war, to provide warriors. And I think this is part of the reason why the story gets kind of messy sometimes, is because the Wolstopway Nation, like I said, they had already attacked Majorville, had already, gone to efforts to essentially declare war, renew war against the British Crown, and distance themselves from the province of Nova Scotia. But the Mi'kmaq had it. The Mi'kmaq weren't in that situation. I think from in my opinion, the Mi'kmaq ambassadors that joined that group were specifically there just to ask about trade. They just wanted to increase the provisions of Machias. They weren't ready to sign a treaty to go to war. And I think that's part of the divide that happened in Watertown in that moment. So the lead spokesperson on behalf of the entire delegation was a man named Ambrose Bear. He was one of the chiefs, second chief, lieutenant chief, also called a captain, from Eckbehock, in one of the Wolstopway settlements. And he essentially says, we are ready to fight, but I cannot tell you for sure how many people or who will come until I go home and ask people, because I didn't come here for that specific purpose. I came for something else. And so I don't want just take over the conversation here, but that kind of to sum it up, eventually what happens is that Massachusetts creates this document, the Watertown Treaty of 1776, that I think really, Harold, you mentioned there's a really one-sided kind of biased perspective to a certain extent, where it's just this is kind of really hopeful agreement saying that this is what was decided upon, but it wasn't decided unless it was completely ratified on the other side. And the representatives, the ambassadors representing Mi'kmaq, Wolstopway did not come down for that specific reason. And if they wanted to sign a treaty to go to war, they needed ratification from the nation. And what eventually happens is the Mi'kmaq nation returns home, the Mi'kmaq delegates return home, and the Mi'kmaq nation chooses not to ratify the document. They are pretty vocal and very clear about that, saying, you know, these actually, it was a pretty interesting letter. I find it fascinating, where they say these young men came to you in the character of chiefs. They did not have the authority to sign a treaty to go to war, and we are choosing not to. And as a national, you know, as a national entity, they chose to remain neutral. I mean, there was lots of individuals that went to war, as things do, but as a national body, they chose to remain neutral. The Wolstoy Nation was different, however. When they actually did decide to go to war, but the treaty itself needed to be renegotiated, and that was a treaty a year later. It's the Ekpahok Treaty. Also, I've seen it called the Wolstoquoy Passamaquoddy Treaty of 1777, in which, you know, they basically said the actually a fascinating letter, I think, from Ambrose Bierce down to Massachusetts, saying that the prices that we were promised, we haven't seen them. It's not coming to pass. The treaty has been broken. The Watertown Treaty he's talking about. And if you actually read the Watertown Treaty, there's nothing about prices in there. And but if you actually read through the minutes, there is. They talk about prices. He promises prices. He promises the James Bowdoin, the president of the council, promises fixed prices, the same prices that they fetch in Boston. But you know, so I mean, that's part of the reason why I think the Watertown Treaty itself is a little bit, you know, it's flawed, because you know it was this hopeful document that you know, Massachusetts sent back to Washington, but they claimed that they really secured something of value. But when the Wolstoquoy Nation returned home, a lot of the things that they thought would be in there weren't in there, wasn't in there. It was, you know, it was negotiated in French, that the language that they spoke, but was actually written in English, and no one spoke English. And probably until they returned home and had someone translate it and realize what's there and what isn't there. The fixed prices weren't there, and it wasn't being honored. And so during the new negotiations in 1777, the Ekpahok Treaty of 1777, those fixed prices were a major point that they negotiated for, and also agreed to fight and traveled out to Machias, and that was the Battle of Machias in 1777, fighting alongside the Continental Army and Passamaquoddy, I can keep going, but I don't want to.
Harold, any comments on that?
As Zeke was just indicating, the complexity that was earlier noted for the Penobscot was parallel with the Maliseet and with the Mi'kmaq. And Zeke also mentioned the language barrier. The leaders of the Wabanaki nations were almost all familiar with French, but not so much English. And so in this case, the translation was actually done by Shaw, who had fetched the delegation to sail to meet the Revolutionary Council in Massachusetts. And Shaw was a translator, and indeed some of the Mi'kmaq joined and went on to join General Washington. But as was very clear, not just for the Wabanaki, but also for the white frontier settlements, that they really couldn't miss anybody to join an army that was fighting in New York or in New Jersey, because they were needed on the ground. You know, so the militia officers demanded that the settlers would provide cannon fodder, basically, for George Washington's army, but they could not be missed. A, they were very often quite hard scrabble. You know, so there was not a lot of money out there. They were needed on the farms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the complexity on the ground that Darren earlier was mentioning, as opposed to what you see is going on in Watertown in the official records, these are two different stories. And that gets exacerbated once you talk about the Wabanaki, where you have one-sided documentation of what was really going on. The other side, we do not know what happened. Things were not translated, just as Zeke just was mentioning with respect to the Waterdown Treaty. That's in English. There's no translation was ever provided that I know of in any of the Wabanaki languages, nor in French. So it's just the English text. And we all know how tricky translations are. I'm a Dutchman, and I'm often telling my wife, who's American, yeah, but we say that, but that word means actually three different things. There's only one word for that in English, and it's three words that we use. I have to make a choice when I translate, which of the three words in English do I use to translate that concept? And so that was even more so for the Wabanaki. Coming back quickly to the Waterdown Treaty, I totally agree with Zeke, what he said about that. But even that is harder to understand given the military situation that had to do with Nova Scotia. You mentioned Nova Scotia, Zeke, earlier, but you know that as well as anybody else, that included what we now call New Brunswick. And the boundary between what is now New Brunswick and Eastern Maine, that was unsettled. So the Penobscot were not even sure after the war whether they fell under Nova Scotia, whether they fell under Quebec, or whether they fell under Boston. It was a very hard situation for them to figure out. And that frontier issue that led to the border question, that was not settled until 1842, the Treaty of the Webster-Ashburton. So the words that we now use, Nova Scotia, has to include quote unquote New Brunswick, which was not yet a term in use at the time. But even the boundary that I just mentioned between Maine and what is now called Canada, that was unsettled. And the whole dispute about where the St. Croix River actually was or was not, that was also in dispute. So the expansionist mentality of Massachusetts always had a grab on not only Machias and beyond, but even into the St. John. That would take their sphere of influence, if you will. And from the British Crown, of course, you had an opposite. So if you compare the maps of the 1770s, 1780s, 1790s, all the way into the 1730s, of those maps that were produced in London, as opposed to the maps that were produced in Boston, you'll see discrepancies repeatedly popping up. So it's a very fascinating thing that if you are an indigenous nation inhabiting that contested frontier, that is not just a contested frontier between the French and the English, but it remains a contested frontier between the Americans and the Canadians under British control after the Revolutionary War. So there's a lot more to be said about it, but as Zeke, I'm quoting Zeke now, I don't want to monopolize the time here, so I'm ceding. Yeah.
Harold, I think that that issue of translation, I don't know. I've been married for 17, almost 18 years, and I find that I can't blame a different language on that. I'm just gonna say like that's just relationships over a long period of time. But I mean, you, I'm extremely lucky to have my partner. What I wanted to rejoin outside of my joke is the idea of that shifting context, because these are agreements and sort of pivots happening in the time of war, right? And I think that that's a really important part of the dynamic, as well as all those complexities that we put forward before. And I just and to bring the Passamaquoddy back into the action too, because they serve as a really critical partner during the war for a variety of reasons that have to do with the Washington's expositions up into Canada, what is now Canada, or to into Quebec, Montreal, and this leads him. I like this. There's Colonel Allen has a great letter to the Passamaquoddies, but I think this one from Washington in December of 1776, as the war is raging, and this is in the aftermath of the Watertown Treaty, where he writes, and he's in somewhere along the Delaware, Bucks County, Pennsylvania. He says, "Brothers of Passamaquoddy, I am glad to hear by Major Shaw," who we've mentioned, given you some context too, right, "that you accepted the chain of friendship which I sent you last February from Cambridge, and that you are determined to keep it bright and unbroken. When I first heard that you refused to send any of your warriors to my assistance when called upon by our brothers of St. John's," meaning the Wollastoq slash Maliseet people, "I did not know what to think. I was afraid that some enemy had turned your hearts against me. I just love sort of this language that Washington's using. But I am since informed that all of your young men were employed in hunting, which was the reason of their not coming. This has made my mind easy, and I hope you will always in future join with your brothers of St. John and Penobscot when required. I have desired, and this is the other piece of this, why it's like about trade as well. I have desired my brother, the governor of Massachusetts Bay, to pay you the money which Captain Smith promised you for sending my letters on to the Mi'kmaq Indians. So you can see, like, this is a wartime effort in the context of a complex trading, series of things about money owed and trading. Like, this is very consistent of what this is entailing for Wabanaki people, and that element of, like, the further you go east out of the control of the further you kind of get away from the scene of the war, it becomes more and more about trade and less about the war effort, and so this influence back and forth becomes a really interesting thing. The same letter, he talks about the bad tribes that sided with the British. He has this long thing. It's not important to read it, but it's also kind of like a low key threat of, like, if you don't, we're gonna come and, like, burn your villages down, like, kind of threat, because he referenced that in the Cherokee context or one of those. But I just wanted to bring that home too as part of that complexity, because it strikes me as a really important thing, and that insight into Washington's voice.
I always find that kind of funny, I guess. I mean, people hold up that document as this, this great alliance and, proof of it, and I'm sitting there thinking it's a threat. That's a threat.
I didn't read the threatening part, but it's basically a threat.
It's always a interesting.
A quick comment. That letter that Darren just read, what's important, of course, is by that time there were already a group of Penobscot and Maliseet, as well as Mi'kmaq, in the orbit of George Washington when he was laying siege from White Plains on New York. And what's not well known is, of course, that when Zeke was referring to the Maliseet, his own people, two chiefs were important, Saint-Aubin, alias Bear, but also Pierre Thomas. And Thomas was actually had gone all the way to George Washington's army camp, and clearly, as later was indicated, felt ignored by George Washington, and returns and is complaining about the treatment that he got when he came back into his own tribal community. And so the other thing is, of course, that the British were heavily manipulating at the same time by offering trade goods at much better terms and better quality than what the Americans were offering. So this whole thing gets very messy and complicated, as Zeke was already indicating earlier.
So, people I've heard, refer to the Watertown Treaty and that stating, how important that treaty was. What's the significance of that treaty? I probably mean it's different depending on what side of the border you're on, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it changes completely if you go over that border. I went to my graduate studies up at the University of New Brunswick. That's where I did a lot of this research. I used to work for Wolstequin Nation, New Brunswick, in the application of treaty work rights. I worked for the Willamotuk First Nation in consultation with the government, and all of that is about treaties. It's all about, application of treaty rights and learning about the timeline of treaties. A lot of treaty education is happening. Nothing is ever said about the Watertown Treaty. People don't talk about it. People don't know about it. From the narrative up there, to a certain extent, it's a necessary narrative. It's that the Wabanaki nations, the Wolstequin Mi'kmaq nations in particular, created a peace and friendship treaty relationship with the British Crown and never broke it. And it remains strong to this day. And that is part of that narrative that they kind of need to reinforce and reclaim treaty rights in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia today. So, to talk about that moment in time when, the Wolstequin Nation in particular chose to ally with the American Revolution, it's one of those taboo things that they don't talk about. Just also to clarify, in 2 years after the Watertown Treaty, we signed the Treaty of Fort Howe, the Peace and Friendship Treaty of 1778, and we re-allied with the British Crown. So it's just like those two moments of just, what happened up from the Canadian perspective is something they just don't talk about. and we'd rather not talk about it.
If I may, that's a very interesting point you make. I started using the Watertown Treaty as of great significance for the Aroostook Band of Mi'kmaq federal recognition struggle because that was located on this side of the border. And the Boston Indian Council, where was a heavy presence of Mi'kmaq, they also began to use it about the same time. That's in the 1980s. So you're absolutely right that from the Canadian side, it was not important, but for the Boston Indian Council, it was important because it established an existing relationship between the Mi'kmaq nation in particular and the United States at a time that the only Wabanaki tribes that were federally recognized or even any recognition were not the Maliseet nor the Mi'kmaq, who were the key players in the Watertown Treaty, as opposed to the Passamaquoddy and the Penobscot. So here you see a document between a government to government quote unquote relationship as a quote unquote treaty that, whatever the weakness of that treaty was in its own historic time of 1776, that had changed by the 1980s when there's a different situation had emerged politically where it was useful for the Mi'kmaq nation to send its grand captain, Alex Denny, to Boston. And it was an official celebration in 1986 of that particular treaty. By that time, I already used it for the Mi'kmaq case in my reporting in 1982, 1983, when I began to search for an established historical linkage of the Mi'kmaq within the contemporary boundaries of the United States. And that, of course, was a foundational piece in our argument to both the state government in Augusta as well as in the federal government in Washington, that the Mi'kmaq had a long-standing relationship, not just as a Canadian tribe that they were always regarded as foreigners, but they actually had a presence, in particular during the Revolutionary War and earlier at the various trading posts. And you earlier, Zeke, were referring to the Mi'kmaq coming down at Machias trading.
Willie, when I think I should have clarified that that kind of dismissal of the Watertown Treaty up in Canada is something that I have always rebelled against. It's something because it's something that I grew up learning in Houlton, learning about the Watertown Treaty, learning about sovereignty and that being a nation agreement, and learning strength from that treaty and being and pride. And I mean, it's something that the reason why I wanted to focus my master's thesis on it was because I wanted to change that narrative and talk about it in a way that, up there in the rest of, my cousins up in Canada don't talk about it in this way. And it should be talked about that way, because in 1776, we oftentimes from the American perspective, we were the first to recognize American sovereignty, the very first, 2 weeks after the signing of the Declaration of Independence. But in that moment, they also recognized our sovereignty as well. That's the nature of a treaty. It's nation to nation, and they recognized our sovereign existence, and yeah, and we recognize theirs. And I just think that's one of those moments in time that we need to talk about and celebrate, and not because it fits within Canada's narrative or the or America's narrative, but because it is our history. It's the historical truth. It's what happened. And
Yeah.
it's just, yeah.
No, I just doubling down on that, Zeke. I think, from Penobscot as well. Like, I mean, that's why we included the Orono, visiting, and having that advance warning. And then that's the other reason why I read that letter from Washington, because he was reliant upon it. Was like it shows you the importance, right, of Wabanaki people at the birth of this new nation, right? That we were seen as other nations, first of all, and that we were seen as a critical force to help in the revolutionary project, right? So that if from George Washington forward, to the extent that for Penobscots too, this idea of an exchange of like we're trying to really prevent incursions, right? You mentioned these incursions upriver. We were like, literally, this is where that 6 mile on either side of the river, you know, but like that's the first time we see the articulated and sort of writing and that appears again in later treaties. But much like what you've been referencing, they try to get rid and Harold mentioned this several times in our last, you know, few shows. Like they almost immediately regret even having that little proclamation part of like that 6 mile, because they're like, oh, I think we gave them too much, because they really wanted to settle the upper, you know, further up on the Penobscot, as they did further up on the Kennebec, as they did on further, you know, like they were always incursion oriented, even than the quote unquote patriots. But they were making deals at the time, which, you know, they needed to just survive, right? I mean, the Revolutionary War was not a predetermined like American win, because they were, you know, the idea that you're taking on the biggest empire in the world, right? That whole thing is a part of this context. And I think, you know, Washington as a general was trying to have as many chess pieces as he could get, because he didn't have that many, you know. And I think you even look at that, like what happens after that, the treaty, the Peace and Friendship Treaty that you talked about in for the Maliseet Mi'kmaq from 1778. You know, there's this really famous defeat at you know, in Castine in 1779. The British built a fort there. Then the Americans sent up the Penobscot expedition. Chief Orono is somehow involved in that, but then, you know, the British routed the Americans horribly in this naval disaster, you know, that led out of that, like attempting to recapture Castine. You know, like there's this whole back and forth of like, where is that frontier space? Who, which Indians are fighting for then, and sort of how that's a movable feast of that border too. So I mean, that plays into all of what happens next, and in some ways confuses the pieces that Harold mentioned of like, where's the border between the United States and Canada? Because the British had, you know, basically dominated, you know, right from the very first naval battle in Machias, right? to this naval battle in Cassie. Like, they're dominating on the coast of Maine, right? The Americans win almost nothing there. Yeah.
As usual, we ran out of time. You've been listening to Wabanaki Windows. I'd like to thank my guests, Dr. Harold Prince, Dr. Dan Ranko, and Ezekiel Crofton, MacDonald Ambassador for the Houlton Band of Maliseets. In our next program, we'll continue the conversation moving from when Maine became a state to the era of the Maine Indian Claims Settlement Act and the modern sovereignty movement. We'll also explore what a more just relationship between the Wabanaki nations, the state of Maine, and the United States might look like in the years ahead. I'm Donna Loring. Thank you for joining us on Wabanaki Windows.